Friends, it's such a pleasure to be here with you all this evening, and especially at such an auspicious time. You know from these two wonderful letters that the Universal House of Justice sent out on the 26th of March that this is the occasion of the centenary of the Tablets of the Divine Plan. And in those letters, there's a testimony to the tremendous sacrifices and efforts that Baha'is have made, both those heroes of the faith, but also the rank and file, who over a century have labored to try to translate what Abdu'l-Bahá said in the Tablets of the Divine Plan into reality and action. And of course, those letters also capture the unique role that your community and its spiritual forebears have played in this process, both directly and in the way that it raised up, contributed to raising up these communities in so many parts of the world. So this centenary is an occasion, I think, to pause and reflect a little bit about who we are and what we're doing. And so I wanted to share some thoughts along those lines with you. As we look around the world and review the news on almost a daily basis, we come to see almost a cacophony of problems that hit us in the face every day. Problems and habits of humanity that reflect a breakdown of the world around us, of the fabric of the society. I don't know about you. I have to confess to my own shortcoming here that whenever I get up in the morning, I start looking at the news. My blood starts to boil. I can't imagine how can people do this, how can this guy say this, and so on. And then I have to pause and calm myself down and remind myself, well, Paul, the old world order is winning all of its goals. It's disintegrating at quite a rapid pace, so I should take heart and not be so upset. But when we look around us, we see, for example, the effect of corruption, and especially political corruption, a moral laxity, and an ingrained prejudice. And we see all of these things, especially in the United States. These are the things you see in the conversations that are really at the heart of this disintegrative process. And these were the evil tendencies that Shoghi Effendi identified in the advent of divine justice. He might as well have been reading the headlines today. And now everywhere we look, these, in various manifestations, these elements are eating away at the fabric of our society. And this behavior is a reflection of the way human beings think. The reality of man is his thought, Abdu'l-Bahá said. And so the world we see around us reflects the thought and actions of the peoples of the world. So you think this way, and then you behave this way, and this is the world you get. And if you don't like this world, if there's a problem with it, then you have to learn how to think in a different way and act in a different way. Now, human beings live in this bubble of their own reality, and this is the society that they produce. The question becomes, for Baha'is, well, what shapes our reality? For example, if we make a posting on our Facebook page, if we begin to engage in social media and so on, what ideas are we reflecting in our engagement with the wider community? Is it what we're taking in from the news every day? Is it what we studied in school? Is it what politicians are telling us? Is it what advertisers are telling us? Are we just echoing the other ideas of individuals on social media? So is the old world order shaping us and our thought and our action, and we're pulled into that conversation? Or does it come from somewhere else? Is our thought and reality shaped by Baha'u'llah? So that whatever we see around us, we're able to take from the pages of his revelation concepts and ideas so that when we enter into that conversation, that's what we're reflecting. So not the processes of a disintegrating old world order, even though it completely surrounds us, even though we're bombarded by billions of dollars worth of media and advertising and everything that's trying to shape our reality and our thought, still, we're not supposed to be shaped by that. We have to use what Baha'u'llah said to us to shape our thinking so that then we can contribute to a conversation of humanity that changes human thought, and then will change human action, and then will change the structures of reality around us. What Baha'u'llah gives us as a picture of reality is sharply different than what the world gives us. The Guardian reminded us, he said, the friends must at all times bear in mind that they are, in a way, like soldiers under attack. The world is at present in an exceedingly dark condition spiritually. Hatred and prejudice of every sort are literally tearing it to pieces. We, on the other hand, are the custodians of the opposite forces, the forces of love, of unity, of peace and integration, and we must continually be on our guard, whether as individuals or as an assembly or community, lest through us these destructive negative forces enter into our midst. In other words, we must beware lest the darkness of society become reflected in our acts and attitudes, perhaps all unconsciously. Love for each other, the deep sense that we are a new organism, the dawnbreakers of a new world order, must constantly animate our Baha'i lives, and we must pray to be protected from the contamination of society, which is so diseased with prejudice. This he said long ago, but it applies to us today more than ever. This difference between what the world is telling us and what it's trying to imprint on us, and what Baha'u'llah is trying to tell us to liberate us from these tendencies and these conceptions, is part of the severe mental test that Abdu'l-Bahá warned would come to those believers in the West. When our conceptions are overtaken by these ideas from the old world order, they become these idle fancies and vain imaginings that Baha'u'llah warned us against. And sometimes it's very hard to discriminate how those forces are such fundamental variants with what Baha'u'llah said. And soon, as the Guardian warned, we're bringing those dark forces into our own thought and into our communities. Now, this condition of the world was diagnosed by Baha'u'llah long ago. He warned that should the lamp of religion be obscured, chaos and confusion will ensue, and the lights of fairness and justice, of tranquility and peace, will cease to shine. So the condition of the world is a reflection of this dimming of the light of religion. And as a result of that, Baha'u'llah says, it manifests itself in two forms. One is religious fanaticism. And he warned that religious fanaticism and hatred are a world-devouring flame whose violence none can quench. He also warned about the other form, which is materialism and ungodliness. He said that the vitality of men's belief in God is dying out in every land. The corrosion of ungodliness is eating into the vitals of human society. So on the one hand, he diagnoses this flame of religious fanaticism, and on the other, this corrosive effect of materialism and ungodliness. And he said only the revelation of God can provide a healing remedy for these two elements. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá analyzed this a bit further, and he said that this dimming of the light of religion is actually the fault of religion. This condition that we find ourselves in, the fault primarily lies with religion. Because he said what happens is that the clergy starts making interpretations of the divine text. And then they claim that there are two trees. One tree is divine, the other one is satanic. And of course, we happen to be the ones that are on the divine tree, and everybody else is on this satanic one. Once you introduce that idea, then the concepts of religion start to change. They're twisted. Division begins, hatred, strife. The truths of religion are replaced by superstitious ideas and ideology. Sedition, warfare, bloodshed, and strife all arise from this, Abdu'l-Bahá explained. And so religion starts to become equated with faith in unbelievable things, blind faith in unbelievable things, that nothing you can see, but believing what you can't see. And as superstition is promoted in the name of religion, then religion only becomes about power and ideology. As one Baha'i author wrote, when religious leaders call superstitious ideas religion, then rational, scientific-minded people start to call religion superstition. There's a connection there. So as the realm of religion declines, then it opens this space for materialism. As Abdu'l-Bahá said, when the sun set, it's time for the bats to fly. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá actually takes the sides of materialists in this argument because he points out that the greatest cause of human alienation has been religion, because each considers himself to be receiving the blessings of God and everyone else to be anathema. And Baha'u'llah, on the other hand, says that religion has to be the creator of concord and love. So Abdu'l-Bahá agrees that if religion becomes this cause of darkness, it's better not to have it at all, just as materialists are saying. But then he calls upon us to reignite this light of religion in the world. Now, what happens with this spread of materialism? It becomes propelled both by the power of science and by the framework of evolutionary thought. But what is it that materialists are saying to people? What are they describing and telling humanity as a result of materialistic outlook in the world? Well, one thing is that human beings are insignificant, a mere speck in an arbitrary part of the universe. Maybe you've seen these charts of the universe and all the different galaxies and so on. And then there's a little arrow pointing to one little corner and it says, "You are here." So this is a conception. We're just one little insignificant speck in the corner. Another thing is that science is the only way to know things, and that whatever science can't know actually isn't real. That human life is just an accident. That if you do this thing over and over again, if you have a universe where you have evolution and so on, well, the human being won't appear. It was just a chance that in all of these possibilities we happen to emerge. And there's even a conception of a multiverse, because the idea of intelligent life is so remote from this perspective, then it's proposed that, well, actually there are multiple universes, none of which have intelligent life, and it just so happens that we are living in the one where this intelligent life appeared. Another conception is that human beings are no more than animals. That if you're intelligent, then you can't be religious. One noted that human beings are nothing but chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. another, seeking to analyze the meaning of consciousness, concluded that, well, consciousness is not real. It's actually just an illusion of your brain. Your brain evolved in order to help you survive, but when you it creates this sense in you that there's a you, but actually this is just an artifact of the brain fooling you. So a rational thinker writes a rational book with rational arguments, trying to explain to other rational people that there's no such thing as rationality. Another argument is that there's no purpose or meaning in the universe. Therefore, it's just up to human beings to invent their own meaning. All of these things I'm describing, these arguments of materialists, are not the findings of science. They're the interpretation of science from a materialistic philosophy. One could easily have a different interpretation. Now, the problem with all of these arguments is that they destroy meaning. They create an ideology of indulgence. One commenter talked about the idea that we've reached an age of exhaustion when ideas on the right and the left fail to inspire people, fail to help them to rise above their own condition. And so people become immersed in just this material indulgence. The meaning of truth is undermined. Even science itself, its findings become attacked, or science itself becomes prostituted to money, which can then buy scientists to do all kinds of studies proving, for example, that cigarette smoking does not cause cancer, or the science on this is unclear, and so on. The other thing is that morals also disintegrate, the sense of what's right and wrong. In European thought, the idea is that that the individual can do anything up to the point where they begin to hurt others. And so that was the framework of liberal morals that admittedly contributed greatly to the advancement of human civilization, taking us to the adolescent stage of the human race. But now when we look around us, we see that, well, actually this standard is disintegrating as well. Because now people can't agree on what's right or wrong. So what a few years ago, people would agree, this is wrong, let a little time go by, and pretty soon there's people arguing, well, no, that's not so bad, that seems to be okay. Plenty of studies, for example, have been done to show the harmful effect of pornography, for example, on young people, or on objectifying women and so on. But let a little time go by and soon you see arguments saying, no, it's actually, there's nothing you can do to restrict it. It has to be free on the internet. Actually, maybe it's actually good for humanity and so on. So every aspect of truth, every aspect of goodness, every aspect of right and wrong, which were standards and pillars by which human beings align themselves, they were appeals to something greater about reality than the human being, and the human being had to conform to this, all are beginning to erode, and the things are adapted. So it's not about truth that I have to accept, it's about my truth and my views. It's not about morals toward which I have to live up to, it's about, well, whatever I do is the standard of morality. So as these elements of the disintegrative nature of a materialist outlook in the world become clearer. And as materialism kind of hits its limits, for example, it's not able to adequately explain, for example, how the human mind works and how consciousness appears. So as it runs up against its own limits, a number of philosophers now and commenters, social commenters, are beginning to question this idea of a material outlook and asking, they're not necessarily calling for a religious one, they're not theists, but they're saying that materialism now no longer works. And being shackled to such an ideology is actually preventing the human race from advancing its thought and action. So this wall that materialism has now hit is gradually beginning to open up investigation of new possibilities. For example, I just want to share one book I was just recently reading. This is an author who does not believe in a God who's a creator of the universe, but in looking at society has kind of identified the limitations of just a materialistic outlook and has called for an understanding of God as an emergent property of human consciousness, that out of evolution, there's a God capacity in human beings, and without it, civilization can't advance. So these are some of the concepts identified in this book. People's sense of identity has drastically expanded over history, from members of a family and tribe to members of an industry, country, or world religion. It's time to take the next step, but not a half step, a giant leap. Today may seem ordinary to us, but it will be mythic in the future of our planet, because it is a pivotal moment. The fate of countless human generations is riding on what we who are now alive decide to do while humanity still has the resources and ability to solve global problems. We need our God capacity to generate the spiritual power, the motivation, trust, and faith in each other to bring about good. No known religion yet emphasizes what really matters, identifying with the human species, seeing its challenges as our own, seeking knowledge of our planetary moral involvement, and demanding that God be a real player in this cosmic drama. No religion can inspire young people even to understand, let alone lead, these transitions. Okay, agree to disagree on that one. The spiritual challenge for us is to accept the scientific picture of the universe and, with the real help of a real God, figure out how to act accordingly in every way, not just technologically, but sociologically, psychologically, spiritually, educationally, politically, and every other way. It may not be obvious how to become this coherent, but for the first time it's possible. And focusing on it as a goal could re-energize our civilization. Spiritual transformation doesn't require a majority vote. It does not matter if most people don't get it. All it takes is a committed minority, because the committed lead culture. So this is the finding of somebody who sees the necessity of God to overcome this materialistic quagmire that we found ourselves in, and then is reaching out and sees these possibilities that I think we would all say we find recognizable. Now, in contrast to this materialistic outlook, of course, Abdu'l-Bahá takes exception to it. He said, if there's no meaning, then human beings become trapped in the struggle for existence. And this struggle for existence is the fountainhead of all calamities and is the supreme affliction. He argues against the idea that the human being is merely an animal. And so he argues that among the teachings of Baha'u'llah is man's freedom. And within the revelation of Baha'u'llah are those concepts and ideas that allow human nature to rise, that liberate human nature from these chains of the struggle for existence. This is a concept that the House of Justice talked about in the Rizwan 2015 message, when it explained that the social consensus around ideals that have traditionally united and bound together a people are increasingly worn and spent. And then quoted Baha'u'llah, they hasten toward hellfire and mistake it for light. Now, in response to this condition of the human race, Baha'u'llah has responded with the healing remedy. He's redefined religion and sought to rekindle its light as a solution to this problem of fanaticism, religious fanaticism, and materialism. So one thing he says to us is, although the world is in distress, no one considers what its cause may be. And he identifies this cause as, no two men can be found who may be said to be outwardly and inwardly united. And he said, ye are the fruits of one tree and the leaves of one branch. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá analyzes this. Remember, he said, the clergy say that there are two trees. One is divine, the other satanic. Baha'u'llah, in this simple statement that every Baha'i child knows and is deep in their heart, knows that ye are the fruits of one tree. There aren't two trees. There's only one tree, and all humanity is on it. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá said, we have the duty to cultivate this tree until it reaches perfection. We might say that one of these leaves, one of these elements of the tree is ignorant. Well, then we have to help it to become knowing. Some are weak and ailing. We have to help them toward health and recovery. Some are infants, and they have to be assisted to attain maturity. He said we should never detest and consider objectionable and show respect and kindness because God created everyone. So this us and them that has plagued the human race since its origin had, in a certain sense, created certain levels of unity, but now holds us back from the highest stage of seeing unity across the entire planet. By this statement, Baha'u'llah has banished this conception. There is no us and them. There is only us. And so we're in this thing together. Another thing Baha'u'llah said is that he talks about how religion produces concrete results in the transformation of the inner life and outer character of humanity. Faith is not belief in the unbelievable, as is said. As Abdu'l-Bahá said, faith is conscious knowledge in action. So in Baha'u'llah's conception, religion is a knowledge system like science. Science is a powerful instrument because in exploring material reality, it tests its ideas in the real world. So it's not just what scientists think or what they say, but these conceptions have to be tested. So if this is a medicine that's going to cure, well, we have to see that cure in reality. And so every aspect of science is tested concretely in the world. But in the same way, Baha'u'llah says, religion proves itself the same way. It's not just about doctrines and concepts and ideas. It's about translating what's written into practical action to transform the inner life of humanity and its outer character. Now, all religions have this conception in some way. Like, for example, in the Bible, it talks about by their fruits you shall know them. A good tree can't bring forth evil fruit, and a corrupt tree cannot bring forth good fruit. So religion also has to be tested in practical action. If the results you see is corruption and strife and war and so on, that's not true religion. That is superstition mixed in with religious ideas. But if the fruits of it are love and unity and concord and the betterment of the world and the transformation of people, well, that is true religion. Baha'u'llah talks about, in this respect, also the harmony between science and religion as our way of kind of investigating reality and understanding and making progress over time. So science and reason in this relationship, science and reason protect religion from falling into superstition. But religion protects science and reason from falling into materialism. So these two things are interactive and reinforcing. Now, as we look kind of at this world we live in now, it begs, in a certain sense, for a response to this revolution that was introduced by the conception of evolution, the theory of evolution, and the understanding of nature on a cosmic scale, that life, that the universe as we know it now existed for 14.5 billion years, that life has existed for 4 billion years. You start to get a cosmic scale. Human beings only appeared in their current form a couple 100,000 years ago. So what's a story, a narrative that reflects that cosmic dimension of reality? Well, it's certainly not a voice of religion that comes at one point in history and says that's the pinnacle of truth, and that everything that deviates from that truth is satanic. But what about Baha'u'llah's idea of progressive revelation? That God speaks again and again to humanity across time. What about Abdu'l-Baha's statement that the Baha'i cycle will last 500,000 years? Maybe the first statement of religion that frames human development in a context of a cosmic scale, really, at 500,000 years. And Abdu'l-Baha's, I mean, Shoghi Effendi's statement that this world order of Baha'u'llah will represent, and its conception of world community, world citizenship, world civilization and culture is regarded as the furthermost limits in the organization of human society on the planet. So it's in that dimension that Baha'u'llah speaks. And in this context, you can see, well, as opposed to these prior statements, it's actually more rational to believe in a God that frames reality in this way than it is to look at the world from the perspective of materialism. It's that God has put into the very seeds of the universe, its very beginning, this capacity for intelligent life to appear, whether it was this form or some other, that this consciousness, just like moments after the Big Bang, there could be carbon, or there could be water, or all the laws of physics were such that this physical world of time and space was shaped, so also the possibilities in this universe that conscious conscious intelligent life could appear, that is conscious not only of self, but conscious of the existence of the universe. So the challenge of Baha'u'llah's redefinition of religion is simply that now that the peoples of the world now have to either reform their own religion, recognize the seeds within it of these same conceptions that Baha'u'llah raised, and purge out these superstitious ideas that have crept in over time, or recognize that God reforms his religion, and to see in the concept of progressive revelation this renewal of religion in every age. So as diagnosed by Baha'u'llah, we live in this world that's wildly out of touch with reality. It's engulfed in this fire of religious fanaticism. It's consumed by this corrosive element of materialism and ungodliness. And then he prescribes the remedy of religion in a radically different form. Then comes the effort then to translate what he said into reality, and particularly our systematic effort in the formative age. And now we have the writings of the Guardian that help us reflect and put this process into context. So, for example, Shoghi Effendi describes for us these three different ages of the faith, which we know well, the heroic age, the formative age, and ultimately, when the promises of the faith are achieved, this golden age that is to appear. And now, of course, you know, if we all had our choice, if we were allowed to pick, we might have liked to pick being around in that golden age to see all these wonderful things that Baha'u'llah said actually become a reality. Or we might have liked to be in the heroic age when we could have been with the central figures and carried out some of these heroic deeds and so on. But, well, whatever your choice might be, lo and behold, you find yourself in the formative age. So what does this mean? Well, this means that all of these teachings that Baha'u'llah gave have to take shape in the world, and it's your job to make that happen. Early on in his writings, Shoghi Effendi said that I feel it's my duty to warn every beginner that the promised glories of Baha'u'llah's revelation can only be revealed in the fullness of time. So we are attracted, maybe we become Baha'is because we're attracted to all these beautiful teachings of Baha'u'llah. Then we come into the Baha'i community and we wonder, well, wait a minute, where's all these wonderful things I read? Well, it's the formative age, my friend. And so the idea is we shouldn't be surprised that these problems are there. We shouldn't be surprised that these struggles are there. What it means to be a Baha'i in this age is that we take those challenges and problems on. If we see a problem, well, we have to be the one who fixes it. It's not just enough to tell the National Spiritual Assembly, hey, there's a problem over here that you have to look into. Shoghi Effendi says, now that you see these problems, now that you can address these issues in your own life, well, then you have to set an example. You have to become the one that contributes to a new pattern of life in your community, to the solution of this problem, or to the overcoming that particular challenge. That's the work of the formative age. Shoghi Effendi reminds us that this process of disintegration actually creates the condition for the process of integration to accelerate. So he describes these two forces at work, that the old world order is disintegrating and a new one is arising in its stead. He said the present plan, the first seven-year plan, embodying the budding hopes of a departed master, must be pursued, relentlessly pursued, whatever may befall them in the future, however distracting the crisis that may agitate their country or the world. They should at no time, however much buffeted by circumstances, forget that the synchronization of such world-shaking crises with the progressive unfoldment and fruition of their divinely appointed task is itself the work of providence. Reflections such as these should steel the resolve of the entire Baha'i community, should dissipate their forebodings, and arouse them to rededicate themselves to every single provision of that divine charter whose outline has been delineated for them by the pen of Abdu'l-Bahá. So it's the very process of disintegration that paves the way for this process of integration to go forward. Abdu'l-Bahá says, wherever we see a thought of hatred, we have to oppose it with a stronger and more powerful thought of love. So wherever we see around us these disintegrative forces at work, we have to resist it with communities that become a bulwark against that disintegration, with social and economic development activities that apply Baha'u'llah's teachings to remedy some of these ills, and with an elevated discourse to participate in all these spaces of human thought and discussion so a Baha'i can be there and bring insights from Baha'u'llah's teachings, not to be affected by this wider disintegrative conversation, but to introduce the seeds of ideas that begin to reverse it. Now, another thing, besides this idea of the three ages of the faith and the process of integration and disintegration, the other thing that another aspect that the Guardian gives us is an understanding of how the faith will grow and develop over time. So he talks about the growth of the faith in three stages. One of these, he says, is a steady flow of fresh recruits. The next stage is a process of entry by troops of peoples and nations into the faith. And then following some series of events out of our control, possibly catastrophic in nature, that will derange the equilibrium of the world, will come a stage of mass conversion of these same nations and peoples into the faith on a large scale. Now, at the beginning of his ministry, Shoghi Effendi patiently guided us in the processes of this steady flow of fresh recruits. And so there were certain methods and certain approaches Baha'is had to the work of teaching and the expansion of the faith. It involved having public meetings, putting articles in the paper, distributing books to carry the faith internationally. People would sail on a boat, go into a harbor, give a talk, distribute some books, get back on the boat, go to the next place, and so on. Gradually, as Shoghi Effendi guided the community, new patterns of activity grew and emerged from it. the concept of firesides, for example, when you can invite people into your home and show them hospitality and overcome their concerns, allow them to ask questions and raise objections and so on and come to understand the faith more fully. The concept of pioneering, whether internationally or on the home front, was born out of practical experience. The idea of going and staying in a place until you raised up an assembly and not moving until the community was well established. This proved by experience, he said, to be the most effective way. And then he recommended it to every national community as part of their plan. Now concepts like firesides, deepenings, pioneering, all of these elements, which are integral parts of a more effective approach to a steady flow of fresh recruits, are well known to us and parts of our community. But then in the 10-year crusade, kind of the culmination of all the Guardians' efforts to educate the community and to get it to advance on a more systematic basis, the Guardian noted that the process of entry by troops was born, first in Uganda and other countries in Africa, later in Indonesia, and after the Guardians' passing, in South America and India and other parts of the world. This ability not to attract people one by one, but by tens, by hundreds, by thousands, by hundreds of thousands, and so on, began to emerge in the Baha'i world. But unlike this long period where he was able to guide us on developing the methods of instruments for a more effective approach to a steady flow of fresh recruits, we found ourselves in this new stage, and he passed away. And so we were struggling to figure out, well, how do we do this process of entry by troops? And 40 years went by, 40 years of effort from the mid-50s to the mid-1990s, where we made efforts, and we saw a continual process of this process taking off and then collapsing and then beginning in another place, then collapsing, until 1996, when the House of Justice said, no, we need a systematic approach to learning about this avenue, and we need to develop concepts, methods, and instruments to identify how to move the process of entry by troops forward in a systematic way. It wasn't never in the statements of the House of Justice that these other elements were to be discontinued. They were effective methods. So in a certain sense, they were necessary to our work, but not sufficient to our work. They by themselves were not sufficient to be able to sustain this process of entry by troops. So a new stage of learning had to open up. One in which we would gradually learn the methods and elements and instruments necessary to sustain entry by troops. And this is what we've been learning for the last 20 years, as the House of Justice described. Now, another element of this that we learned is that the concept of entry by troops is not just about getting a lot of enrollments, which we thought at one period of time, but kept leading to this process of an explosion of enrollments and then a collapse. But it's actually a pattern of action in which expansion and consolidation go hand in hand. It's around community building. It's about groups of people, Baha'is with others, learning how to put the teachings of Baha'u'llah into action to transform our inner character and also to change the society around us. And it's about integrating our conception of what it means to teach the faith with the conception of what it means to consort with the wider society. This tension that we have between direct and indirect methods, that we should teach everyone directly, or no, we should take an indirect posture and so on, so indirect that we actually forget to come back around and do some direct teaching from time to time. Well, this question was actually raised to Baha'u'llah at one point, where somebody posed the question of, well, what is this idea? Some religions proselytize and they're quite aggressive in getting new recruits. Other ones seem not to have any conception of teaching at all. So what is it? What is the proper balance here? And so Baha'u'llah explained that, he said, the children of men are all brothers, and the prerequisites of brotherhood are manifold. He said, it behooveth him who is the recipient of an inward or outward gift, or who partaketh of the bread of heaven, to inform and invite his friends with the utmost love and kindness. So this is a spiritual obligation. We're all the leaves of one tree. We're all one family. I possess a wonderful gift. I am obligated to share that gift with my family, with my brethren. If they respond favorably, he said, his object is attained. Otherwise, he should leave them to themselves without contending with them or uttering a word that would cause the least sadness. So in this context, it's not that we shed this fruit of the divine tree and cast them onto this tree, this satanic tree. No, all are part of this one tree. If we share this gift and people accept it, our object is achieved. If they don't, they're still in the family. They're still part of us. And our pattern of life has to reflect that. And so in the communities that we're building, we're able to do that. We're able to create this pattern. And the House of Justice discussed it in the recent plan in the terms of this idea of carrying on various conversations. So we should be able to engage the people of the world, elevate these conversations that are going on. Each book in the sequence of courses gives us an idea of the kinds of conversations we could be carrying on. Of course, there's many others inspired by the teachings. So to learn how to speak about spirituality or the education of young children or about the history of the faith and its meaning for humanity or about the purpose of life of a young person and the way of mentoring other younger people and so on. These are all conversations we could have with people, as well as this conversation of a direct presentation of Baha'u'llah, and then become adept in engaging the people of the world and consorting with everybody and knowing when we should be more indirect and when we should be more direct, whether that direct teaching comes at very early or whether it comes much later. It all depends on the receptivity of that person. And our ability to engage people in that wide range of conversations and to act in these areas of community building, social action, and involvement in the discourse of society starts to create a new dynamic that reverses this process of disintegration in the world. And it brings to the conception this idea of leaven that's talked about in the writing. So the leaven is not the entire loaf of bread. It's an ingredient in the whole, and the whole then rises. And so Baha'is are called to be this, to create this context, and to be this agent, this catalyst in the wider society. So what we're learning how to do in these clusters is gather thousands of people and participate in this process of community building, in conversations, and in social action that can gradually translate what Baha'u'llah said into action that quenches this flame of religious fanaticism and is the remedy for this ungodliness and is the creation for the dawning of a new process of civilization building. So now that takes us then to what we're doing now. And again, I don't have time. Obviously, the House of Justice has written about this. And you're quite familiar. You've studied the various recent letters. You know the processes of the last 20 years, how we've gradually developed one element after another. In this last five-year plan, what we've seen finally is all of these elements coming together in a way where there's nothing new that needs to be discovered. We've basically discovered these elements, and we see that when we can put them together in the mature way, what we have is a process of growth that can get bigger and bigger and is sustainable over time. So it's this what we're seeing at these most advanced clusters in the world that have moved beyond the third milestone, that pattern of activity we now have to draw from it, take insights from it, and see how we move clusters along this whole path. Now, again, you look around you and you say, well, you know, I don't immediately see that around me. But again, there are about 15,000 or more clusters in the world. Right now, Baha'is are only working in about 5,000 of them. So that's two-thirds of the world where we don't even have a program of growth begun. Out of those 5,000 programs of growth, we have 200 that are at this really advanced stage, and maybe another 800 to 1,000 which are kind of right behind that, which are at the second milestone or struggling at that level or having moved beyond it. That leaves some 3,500 to 4,000 clusters, which are only at the beginning of this movement, things that are quite fragile. So the House of Justice described, again, not to define it, but a sense of it in numerical terms, this first milestone is one or two people who are engaging maybe two or three families, 10 or 12 people or whatever. By the time of reaching the second milestone, you have maybe 20 to 30 workers able to engage 100 or more people. And by the time you get to the third milestone, 100 or more workers engaging 1,000 or more people. So on a quantitative level, it's an order of magnitude of about 10. So you're multiplying the number of workers and the people they're able to embrace roughly by 10 times across each of these milestones. But of course, there's also an element of organic complexity with it that comes with it as well. As a kind of an analogy, I kind of think of it as the first milestone is kind of like a fertilized egg. It's just the dawning of a new life that comes into existence. But very simple, not complex at all, that faces certain challenges, can't do everything, but must multiply cells, and thus must learn how those different cells are organized and so on. The second milestone is kind of like birth. When all of the elements are there, and finally this organism is viable and can be born into the world, but it's still quite simple in its operation. Finally, the third milestone and beyond are childhood and the stages beyond it. So we have to think of the nature of our work along these lines. If you don't go to an embryo and say, you know, why aren't you going to school now? You know, I mean, what are you talking about, you know? Or you have to kind of look what stage is that embryo in. And it's not doing everything at once. There's a time when it's just about multiplication. You can't think about developing a brain when you're one cell. You need a few more cells at least. But then there's also a time in the development of the embryo where now developing that brain is the most critical thing. And if the mother doesn't get the right nutrients, well, the intelligence of that child is stunted forever. So that's a critical period, and the development of the brain is the most important thing, and it needs the attention it needs at that particular time. So we have to begin to think about this work along this organic line. Now, just to give you a kind of a sense of where we're going, if we look at these most advanced clusters, these 200 and so on, and they have about 100 people engaging 1,000, again, maybe there are some in this country, so maybe, you know, some of you have visited or you used to live in some of these communities and so on. So again, it's something known, something that's a reality. The most advanced cluster in the world has more than 10,000 people engaged in its activity. So this is not theoretical. This is proven by experience to be effective, and we have to learn how to spread it to other people. So you see, what we know right now is enough to create a radical transformation in the Baha'i community, if we can replicate what's already known in cluster after cluster. So we need to advance these clusters, and the primary focus of the plan, is one of its predominant and heaviest goals, is the movement of these 3,000 to 4,000 clusters to the second milestone by an order of magnitude of 10, from 2 or 3 people to 30 or more people, from 10 people participating to more than 100. And the House of Justice has gone into some detail to explain the nature of the effort that has to be done in order to get us there. And again, I'm not going to recapture that. But you can see it's a list of things that on the one hand might be looked at as a list, work with youth, work in a neighborhood, have reflection meetings, do cycles and so on, but could also be looked at as an organic element that are intertwined, that you talk to youth in a neighborhood, you bring them together, you create study circles for them, you multiply core activities. You now have to appoint agencies to support that process. You talk to the parents and so on. You create devotional meetings. Very quickly, you're working with more than 100 people as you work to establish 5 junior youth groups. This is just one path to this process. There are others. Now, this process can be looked from with inside the cluster. So every group of people, wherever they are, however few, needs to add one worker per cycle over the course of the 20 cycles, and they can achieve and get to this second milestone. But at the same time, there's a host of agencies, the auxiliary board members and their assistants, the reservoir clusters, the training institutes, the regional Baha'i councils, which are learning how to organize in a way that supports this organic development of these agencies, of these clusters to the second milestone. Then, of course, is the second pattern of learning, which will be among, you have about 400 or 500 clusters, you have to move along that level. But then you have another 100 clusters that can begin to learn about the second path, which is the movement from the second to third milestone. Again, a capacity of an element of building capacity. We can look at this on the one hand as multiplying activities. But if we do, we're missing the point of the plan. Activities are not an end in themselves. They're a space where people can come and be with us and interact with the Word of God. And then a dynamic begins to emerge where we can accompany, whether it's children or junior youth or young people or people of any age, to begin to move along a path. Even a devotional meeting is not just a meeting that's an end in itself, but it's a space. It's the seed of the Mashkal Askar. It's a space where people come, where they're touched by the Word of God. And then the host needs to not just tick off the fact that, okay, I held a devotional meeting this week, but has to look at those people who come and see how the Word of God is affecting them. So everything that we're doing in these clusters is about the development of the capacity of people, Baha'is or not, to work at ever higher levels to put Baha'u'llah's teaching into action. Now this work of the growth and development of community life and teaching is not the only aspect of the plan. Sometimes we think of the plan as collapsed into just institute process or just core activities, but far from it. Those are just a piece of the organic whole that is much greater. And that thing that is much greater goes beyond just the level of community building processes. So, for example, the House of Justice has talked about this involvement in social action. And again, in some of our most advanced clusters, but even in the weakest, where we have a junior youth group, a process begins very early where people begin to apply Baha'u'llah's teachings and look at the material ills and problems of humanity and begin to address how to resolve them. So in the Baha'i world, we have thousands, more than maybe tens of thousands of small-scale Baha'i social and economic development activities that are going in the world. We have hundreds of sustained projects like schools or health clinics and so on. And then we have 100 or so Baha'i-inspired agencies which are able to take on the work of social action on a more complex level. And the Office of Social and Economic Development is working with Baha'i communities and individual believers in different parts of the world to facilitate the process of learning about this effort. So you saw in the video, Frontiers of Learning, one of the segments was on India, and you began to see these friends talking about, through their efforts, the impact on the thinking of the people, where this one woman said, I'm not going to teach my child what caste they're in, because I don't want my child to feel inferior to anybody. And I don't want my child to feel superior to anyone. So here's this oppressive structure of the caste system. How long has it imposed itself on that society? Now, through the quickening power of the Word of God and this pattern of activity, it begins to erode the power of this thing, begins to erase it. It's just a little stirring, a little signal, but shows the potential capacity of these efforts to change the thought of humanity and then begin to change its action. So one area of learning, for example, is that OSED is facilitating is this idea of community schools, where they have Baha'i classes, but then if you give the teachers a little more training in certain communities, they can create a kindergarten, a little more a first grade, a little more second grade, and so on, until they actually build a little community primary school. Now, this process has proven to be very effective. Abdu'l-Bahá originally had the vision in Iran that when the Baha'is created this one school and it proved to be effective, he said, now create another and another and another. So you go all throughout Iran, so you educate all the people of Iran, not just the Baha'is, but whether they're Muslim, whether they're atheist, whether they're Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian, all the people of Iran should be educated, both in material education and in moral education and character training and so on. So he had this vision of the transformation of society through education. So in this area, OSED is learning about creating these small community schools. And gradually the process is growing and developing. In one country in the Central African Republic, where, again, this process of disintegration is very strong, and the breakdown of the old world order is affecting the ability of the government to deliver education, suddenly you have the emergence of these Baha'i-inspired schools. And the government became interested and even did some testing and saw that in some of these schools that were started by the Baha'is, the fourth grade students were outperforming the sixth grade students of the government. And now this agency, the ADIE Foundation in Central African Republic, is now has been drawn into consultation with the government about the processes of education in the country. And it's moved from developing these community schools to developing so many community schools in a single cluster that now they're trying to create agencies that can facilitate the continued development of these schools. And they've also become involved in the design of curriculum from a Baha'i-inspired perspective for the educational system. This program has now proven to be effective and has been gradually spread. It's now about 27 Baha'i-inspired agencies in different parts of the world have developed 427 schools with over 1,300 teachers and some 28,000 students in 175 clusters in 20 countries. And this is where the process is now. It's much further than it was 5 years ago. It'll be much further than it is now. So this whole sphere of learning about education, which Abdu'l-Bahá is so fundamental to the transformation of society, we're now engaging in it at different levels. We have various schools. We're working at secondary education. We have a couple universities. We're trying to learn how to create systems of education that will complement then this forces of our community building and growth process. But beyond this is also then the level of involvement in the discourses of society. And the House of Justice said, well, this takes place at different levels. There's this one conversation on the international level guided by the Baha'i international community, especially at the United Nations, but in other fora. But then there are also levels within a national community. One is discourses in a national level that the National Assembly is learning about. So you look at some of the issues that are of concern for the society, you figure out how can Baha'is participate in that conversation, understand the various voices that are being raised, figure out which ones are most closely related to the perspectives of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, and then engage in that perspective and bring the light of the teachings to bear and elevate the conversation and change it. But this space is also available in clusters where there's intensive activity, in neighborhoods where it gets to a certain level. Baha'is are naturally drawn into the conversations of their communities. So there are examples like in Sydney, in a cluster in Sydney, the work with youth and junior youth has now had an impact on the gangs in a certain neighborhood, effectively dissolving the membership of these gangs as the young people are pulled into the conversations surrounding the junior youth program. But beyond this is also what the House of Justice envisioned every single social space that a Baha'i occupies, meaning in your profession, in the agencies of civil society where you are, in the PTA, wherever a Baha'i is placed, wherever a Baha'i stands within the contact of that space, well, they can learn to be in that conversation, elevate that discourse, and bring the light of Baha'u'llah's teachings to bear, so that gradually this process of thinking and action begins to change. So Baha'is are doing this professionally. They're doing this as individuals. There are friends who are now writing books and articles. Maybe you've seen this book called 11 that's written by this Baha'i from Canada, Paul Hanley. It's about the future of this next century when it's expected that 11 billion people will be on the planet. So he goes and analyzes these different forces at work in society, brings to the attention of people that, well, the society is organized this way because this is the way people think. And if we continue to act this way, we're going to reach a crisis point in this century when we simply outpace the resources of the planet. We simply don't have enough resources to sustain water, food, energy for 11 billion people. And so the result will be dislocation, war, strife, because of the disequilibrium of the world, unless we begin to think differently and act differently. And the last chapter of this book begins to present the Baha'i community's pattern of action with the plan as a different one example of a community thinking differently and acting differently and creating patterns that can grow strong until they can begin to affect the patterns of society. So this capacity for involvement of discourses is growing, and different national communities are developing these different capacities. And we see in all kinds of places, in the Arab region, in Canada, in Germany about migration, in Colombia where they had civil war and now they're making peace. Well, the Baha'is are in that conversation in the society about peacemaking between the rebels and the government and so on. In all these arenas, we're finding space to contribute to the Baha'i perspective to the conversation. But even this isn't all. You've seen in letters of the House of Justice discussions of certain new offices that are created for helping national assemblies to build their capacities in the area of their treasuries and their secretariat and their properties, agencies to assist national assemblies in developing their capacities for involvement in the discourse of the society, the building of seven temples, including those at the national and local level, letter to the Association for Baha'i Studies, talking about the importance of Baha'i scholarship and seeing how it plays a complementary role in these various aspects of our endeavors, disaster relief as an endeavor of the international Baha'i community. You saw that story from Tana, how the Baha'is were active in helping the community recover from the cyclone and so on. There's an accelerated process for the organization of the sacred text to gather all of the work, organize its basis, typeset, proofread, and begin a process of accelerating the publication in the original language, but also the translation into English, and then by extension into other languages. So the framework we have that we initiated very simply in 1996 now creates a broad context for the efforts of the plan. The plan is not a narrow thing. It's not a space for a few people who like to have a study circle. That study circle is an irreplaceable element to be able to accelerate the training of human resource at a fast enough pace to keep up with an accelerated engagement with the wider society. But by itself, it's like one cell or one organ in a whole organism. It has to be complemented by all these efforts. And like every cell in the body, it has to be a universal participation of all these cells, harmonized and combined together, fulfilling the role of all these various organisms if the organism is going to grow and be strong. Now, I know I'm going a little long, but I think it's important to make these points. One of the things the House of Justice said is in the 26 March letter is that hopefully now the friends can appreciate the straight path that has been traced by heavenly inspiration from the dawning of the formative age, from the first revelation of these tablets of the divine plan to today. We tend to experience the development of the faith as a bunch of twists and changes. So to us, it's moving. Now this thing seemed to be reversed. Now it's going a different way. But if we can get some distance, now after this lapse of a century, we can stand back and see, for example, how well Baha'u'llah predicted the ills that are afflicting humanity, how the Guardian gave us the vision of how we're going to deal with this thing, and set us on the path of learning how to engage it in a systematic way, and how each stage of the divine plan built on the one that came before us and took us to this particular place. Now, the past 20 years, we're engaged with, sometimes, you know, you experience a lot of difficulties and struggle. We had certain assumptions about what the plan was. At one point, somebody said, well, we should have study circles and not firesides. Or, well, local assemblies used to do this thing for teaching, but now the friends were supposed to wait till the local assembly made its plan. Now we're saying the friends should act before the local assembly has even approved their plans and so on. We might have had one idea of how counselors and auxiliary board members were supposed to function. Suddenly we're seeing, no, they're functioning in a different way. Sometimes these changes were the results of mistakes or misunderstanding of what the guidance was. Other times, it was guidance that actually, it's not the guidance that was misunderstood, it's the fact that we had formed conceptions in our own mind that was at variance with the guidance. Again, these are all parts of the organic development of the faith, parts of the test that Abdu'l-Bahá said we would face, severe mental tests. But it's not just something of this past 20 years, it was also the same pattern that existed at the beginning of the formative age, when Shoghi Effendi introduced the administration. And it took 16 years of helping the friends understand the administration and then doing all kinds of things, nominations for membership on the National Spiritual Assembly, electing National Assembly members by proportionate vote, electing more than 9 people to local assemblies and so on. All these different things because they didn't understand and they made mistakes and he gradually and patiently taught them. Then he had to teach them all about teaching and so on. And so bit by bit, the friends learned things that now we take for granted, but at the time caused a lot of stress and strife, both for those who were Baha'is who were sincere, but also those who became disenchanted with the faith and systematically went about to create problems and so on. So what we're experiencing has been experienced at every stage where the faith is growing and developing. If you look at, say, this organic development from a caterpillar to a butterfly, if you're very experienced with caterpillars, you wonder, what the heck is this chrysalis? Where did the caterpillar go? Why is this caterpillar hiding from me? Much less when it pops out as a butterfly. Now it's like, oh, God, I don't know what the heck that thing is. So this is the nature of growth sometimes. It changes and develops in ways that we don't understand. But from the perspective of the covenant, we can walk in this light of divine guidance, confident that we're following a straight path. Whatever it looks like to us in the trenches, we're confident in this divine guidance that will take us to where we need to be. So the House of Justice has now raised for us this vision, not only of this very important 5 years where we have to achieve these very important objectives by the year 2021, the centenary of the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá and the dissemination of his will and testament, but also beyond that then to the year 2044, the end of the second Baha'i century. And the House of Justice explained that we have to understand now what we can begin to see as a straight path where Baha'u'llah diagnosed these ills. Shoghi Effendi identified these evil tendencies in our society, as if he grabbed them right from the headline. Then he called upon the Baha'i community to develop itself to the point where it could eradicate these evil tendencies from the wider society. Because he said, the majority, if America is to fulfill its destiny, then the majority of the people of the society have to be freed of these evil tendencies of corruption and moral laxity and ingrained prejudice. And it's up to the Baha'i community to be the catalyst that facilitates that transformation so that the world order of Baha'u'llah can be born. Shoghi Effendi said the first stirrings of that world order will take place in the second Baha'i century. So within this horizon of the year 2044, the first stirrings, not of the administration, of the world order. And again, looking at this crisis of humanity and this emergence, when you look at some of these clusters in the world, there's one island, for example, there's about 100,000 people in it, and 50,000 live in the capital city. 2,000 of those 50,000 are participating in Baha'i core activities. 4% of the population of the capital. Over the course of the plan, they hope to raise that to 10,000 people. 20% of the population of the capital. Well, how long, especially in these intense spaces, before people start to see what you're seeing in Tana and other places, this impact, this profound impact of Baha'u'llah's teachings on young people, on how they develop, on how they see themselves, on how they dedicate themselves to the betterment of the world. What parent doesn't want that? Who's going to dismiss that? All are going to want it, and it's not just good for the few, it's for everybody. So for the first time, we start to see the potential latent in entry by troops. In Sydney, in Australia, the capacity of reaching out to youth is built into the 6-monthly efforts of the community. Every 6 months, they have a youth gathering, and they bring more youth into the conversation. And then they begin to systematically work with them over 6 months to train them, bring them further, help them to become animators or children's class teachers, and integrate them into the pattern of life. What is entry by troops if it's not the systematic ability every 6 months to reach out to another group of people and bring them in and integrate them in the process, and 6 months later begin to reach out and integrate them again? But when that dynamic grows to such an extent, you can see, and as a population looks on at that process, then one can begin to see the possibilities of what Shoghi Effendi talked about of mass conversion. That as the old world order continues to disintegrate, and people see the stark choice between the reality of what's happening in the world and the possibilities that exist in the Baha'i community, then the idea of mass conversion is not so magical and mystical anymore. It becomes almost an inevitability in that kind of context that we're seeing around us. So friends, we have then the challenge of this next 5 years before us. This is a spiritually charged moment, intertwined in the centenary of the Tablets of the Divine Plan at the beginning and the centenary of the Will and Testament at the end. And in the middle, these two wondrous anniversaries, the bicentennials of the birth of Baha'u'llah and the bicentennial of the birth of the Bab, which will celebrate now the whole Baha'i world as a twin observance, this most great festival where will be able to create a space where the peoples of the world will, in ever greater outreach than ever before, will recognize this precious light that was introduced into the world. So we're working to get 5,000 programs of growth to this second milestone, and several hundreds more of these up to the third milestone, and which will call for a tremendous multiplication, not just of sheer numbers, really moving hundreds of thousands, if not million or more, into this circle of our activities, but also the necessary work to create the structures to support it, this Herculean labors that the House of Justice called for. But what's more important than the work of just this 5 years is the capacities that this 5 years will create in our community, in the individuals, in the communities, and in the institutions that will lay the stage for all those plans and cycles of effort that lie ahead for moving millions of more people before the close of the second Baha'i century. So let's see what the results of our labors will be in the next 5 years and what achievements we'll have to offer as a gift to Abdu'l-Bahá on the centenary of his passing. Thank you very much, friends, for your time.